Apparently not. I thought about going to the bridge, but decided that might cause more disruption than it was worth. So I went to my old quarters. Do you know they are untouched since I was arrested?
Neither had Drake's been, so he supposed that wasn't a huge surprise. Perhaps they'd intended to make wholesale changes once Rutherford had returned to Vigilant and a new captain had been assigned to Ajax. Drake cast his glance at Carvalho, who was now fully strapped into the suit and using its powerful hydraulic arms to move the heavy crates of sugar. Even the little bit salvaged was enough to addict 100 Hrum. A single taste for the pilot would destroy the progress made in detoxing him. Nibpim's tongue snaked over his pink lips. He didn't turn to look at the work.
Perhaps we could go somewhere else. Somewhere with fewer temptations.
Of course. Drake gestured toward the doors, positioning his body so as to block the view of the sugar as they moved.
A moment, sir.
Nibpim turned to Barker.
Gunner,
he began. Chief engineer now, Drake corrected.
Indeed.
The Hrum had no eyebrow to raise, but it was in his tone.
Chief Engineer Barker, can you bring us to Point 092 with the pirate ship in tow?
Aye, but Captain says we need more than 10% the speed of light to make the second jump.
There's another jump in the Red Dwarf system, a looser jump. We can go through at a lower speed, but it requires a bigger pivot and takes us in the wrong direction.
Don't much like the sound of that, Barker said. What do you mean the wrong direction? Drake asked carefully.
The jump is inside the corona of the Red Dwarf,
Nibpim said.
But if you put me in the pilot's chair, I can take all of us through to the other side.
Chapter 15. Tolvern sprang from her chair when the door to the bridge opened, and Nibpim ducked his head to come in. Her heart thumped, and her hand went for her sidearm. But before she could draw it, the captain followed behind. His posture was firm and confident, and the commander relaxed. Cap rose from the oversized pilot's chair where she'd been lounging. She stared at the Hrum, with a scowl deepening over her face. She'd pulled up the sleeves on her jumpsuit to show off those ridiculous lions on her forearm, but now pulled her sleeves back down, as if self-conscious of her station in life. The tattoos were a reminder of that. Well, what did Cap expect, anyway? 2 weeks ago, she'd been a prisoner on her way to the Helium 3 mines. Before that, she'd served as a Marine corporal, and before that, some kind of smuggler. Did she think she'd be permanently elevated when they had one of the finest pilots in the Navy waiting in the wings? Wean the Hrum from the sugar, and of course he would be preferable. For the moment, Drake ignored Tolvern's questioning look and made his way to where Cap stood. "How long until the jump?" Drake asked.
"Jane says 47 minutes,"
Cap responded.
"Maintain course. Barker has new information about the parameters of the jump and what we'll need from the engines. You will check with him."
"Wait," Cap said, sounding confused. "You mean I'm still doing the jump?"
"Yes, Ensign, of course."
A slight frown passed over Drake's face. "Now is not the time to interfere with your work. Unless you're unsure of your calculations, that is." A moment of silence. Then he added, "Well, are you?"
"No, sir."
"Good. There might be a change on the other side, though, and it will get tricky. Nibpim will handle that jump."
"Yes, sir."
Drake gestured toward the war room.
"Commander."
Tolvern followed him and Nibpim back. She cast a glance at Cap, who settled back into the pilot's seat with a sigh and a renewed look of complacency. The captain turned up the lights in the war room and shut the door. Tolvern sat opposite the captain. Nibpim took a seat on the end and seemed to collapse into the chair, his face slack, his limbs dangling. He carried an expression of deep exhaustion, as if he'd only managed to hold himself upright with the greatest of effort.
"You're giving Cap a false sense of security, you know," Tolvern said.
How so?
She's going to think she's really some sort of assistant pilot, not someone warming the seat until we get Nib Pim back where he belongs.
I meant all of that, Commander.
Drake certainly looked serious enough. All ships have an assistant pilot. Anything can happen in space, and you don't want to be stranded because you were relying on one man. Or whom, in our case.
That doesn't mean we want Cap on the bridge. Put her in engineering or stick her in the kitchen cooking eggs or something.
I'd rather have her where I can keep an eye on her.
You really think she'll get in that kind of mischief in a few days?
Maybe, maybe not. I'm thinking long term.
Tolvern stared.
Wait, aren't we dumping her at San Pablo or wherever?
I'm not so sure anymore. Not sure about leaving any of them behind, to be honest.
You can't be serious, she said.
We need more crew members, not fewer. So unless you think we are likely to find more reliable people in the port of San Pablo than we've already got...
They could hardly be worse.
Nib Pim cleared his throat.
Discipline seems somewhat more lax than when I last sat in this room. Since when do the crew of Ajax speak this way to their commanding officer?
Tolvern flushed, ashamed at her conduct.
I am sorry, Captain. Forgive me, I misspoke.
Drake dismissed her apology with a wave of the hand.
We've had a rough go of it, he told the room. Mutiny, attacked twice by the Navy, then this fight with the pirate ship. I am carefully choosing my battles until I decide what to do next. Tolvern is excitable, but she doesn't worry me. I'm more concerned with you.
Nib Pim stared at him, unblinking.
I would imagine.
Are you prepared to take the pilot's chair? Drake asked.
No, I'm not prepared. I wish I had a few more days in the sick bay.
Doesn't seem to be a rush, Tolvern said. We can use Cap through to the Red Dwarf system, then bring Nib Pim around later.
Drake shook his head.
The pilot has other ideas. A looser second jump so we can haul Captain Kidd through with us. Cap can't do it. Only Nib Pim.
What are you worried about? Tolvern asked the room. The trips? The detoxing?
It will be a fast transition,
Nib Pim said.
I'll need to be mentally alert.
Tolvern had another concern, now that she thought about it.
Is your nav chip on?
It was disabled when I was arrested.
Doc can turn it back on, Drake said. But you'll need time to run diagnostics and download the current map set before you interface with the nav computer.
That shouldn't take long,
Nib Pim said.
Half an hour, maybe.
Which didn't leave them much time, she noted. Nevertheless, the three of them fell into silence, with the captain staring hard at his pilot.
You want to know why?
The room said, at last. It was not a question.
I want to know the why of a whole lot of things, Drake said. You say the attack that put me before the tribunal was not an accident. That the Royal Navy removed something from the wreckage. That you voluntarily became a sugar eater. Yes, I find myself curious.
There is a cure for the sugar eaters.
A what?
Both Tolvern and Drake asked at the same time.
Better call it an antidote. Something taken into the body that blocks the absorption of sugar into the room brain, renders it as harmless as soda water. You administer a single dose, and a room will never again swoon, whether he's an addict or not.
I've never heard of such a thing, Tolvern said, skeptical.
She glanced at the captain, who was frowning, then back to Nib Pim.
Are you sure?
I'm not making it up,
the room insisted.
I didn't say you were, she said. But maybe someone told you that and you wanted to believe.
I'm no enemy of humans,
Nib Pim said.
After my family broke apart, I was raised by human missionaries. I joined the Royal Navy of my own free choice. Of course I look at the decay and destruction of my native civilization with sorrow. But this began long before I was born, generations ago now. It seemed inevitable. The human race is young and energetic. The Hroom are tired and ancient. The sugar wars were both sign and symptom of the disease. The decay could not be fought,
Nib Pim continued.
Only managed. Some of us could take our place within the new human order. I understood the missionaries. Their goal was to keep more room from becoming eaters. I never dreamed there would be an antidote.
I still don't believe it, Tolvern said. If such a thing were possible, the whole sector would know about it. She looked to the captain for help, but he was stroking his chin thoughtfully.
I learned of it, hacking into the network,
Nib Pim said.
And I knew at once I had to bring it to light. And I knew people would want to stop me. Humans would stop me. No human would want such a thing to be known.
We are not all slavers, Drake said quietly.
No,
Nib Pim said. He fixed his big dark eyes on the captain.
Who invented this so-called sugar antidote?
Tolvern asked, still suspicious.
A doctor? A scientist? Who can corroborate your story?
Nobody can corroborate it. Not anymore. The researchers are dead. Murdered. As are many others who learned of its existence. The antidote was taken from the merchant ship that Captain Drake is accused of destroying, and its existence covered up. From there, it went to Henry Upton, on its way to Hart Barsa. There is a small group of free room living in the jungles there, renegades and refugees. I arranged to be taken as a slave to the planet where I could be rescued by them.
How would you manage that as an eater?
Tolvern asked.
You wouldn't want to be rescued, not if it meant taking you from the sugar. You'd have confessed the whole thing to your new masters.
Maybe,
Nib Pim said.
I had to take the risk. We had to know where they were hiding the antidote, so we could raid the lab and liberate it.
Then what? Drake asked. You'd free the slaves of Hart Barsa? What would keep the Royal Navy from landing 100,000 marines to put down the revolt?
100,000 men cannot control 14 million square miles of jungle and swamp. Meanwhile, we'd find a way to smuggle the antidote off-world. Soon we'd have 12 rebellious worlds. I see your troubled look,
he added, looking back and forth between the captain and the commander.
You could never tolerate such a thing.
There are millions of whom living on human planets, Drake said. A widespread rebellion would be an ugly thing.
Now you see what I mean. Every human is a slaver.
The thought of a general slave revolt terrified Tolvern. Even on Albion itself, where there was hostility to slavery as opposed to free labor, there were several million slaves. On the sugar worlds, eaters outnumbered humans 8 to 1. And if the free room working for the York Company were counted, the ratio was more like 10 to 1. The same pattern played out through the several dozen inhabited systems in this part of the galaxy. Put all the humans together, Albionish, Ladino, and New Dutch alike, against a renewed Hroom Empire, no longer crippled by billions of sugar-eaters, and the scenario turned scary. Tolvern had always thought Nib Pim, one of the crew, as loyal to the Navy as anyone else. Now she looked at him with fresh eyes. He was an alien intelligence from a vast, ancient people. In comparison, were humans young and energetic, or small and vulnerable?
Captain, she said, we should talk in private, don't you think?
Drake ignored her. I don't understand why the Navy would destroy the merchant ship and pin it on me. If this antidote truly existed, few people would have balked at the death of a small number of civilians to see it destroyed. We were fighting the Hroom at the time. We needed every advantage.
Peace talks had already begun, Tolvern said. Maybe the Admiralty was worried the Empire would send another fleet in anger if they found out.
Except they didn't destroy the antidote, Drake said. Nib Pim says it's on its way to Hart Barsa. They killed the scientists and researchers. Why not destroy the antidote, too?
I don't know the answers to those questions,
Nib Pim said.
That wasn't my concern so much as getting my hands on it, and seeing it spread far and wide.
And you're still determined to do it? Drake asked. Recover the antidote, I mean. There was a firm set to the captain's mouth that Tolvern recognized, and a flinty look in his eyes. It was the same look he'd worn as they'd overtaken the pirate ship. The same look as when he'd led them at the Battle of Kif Lagoon, where Drake and Rutherford had annihilated a much larger room force. That look normally stirred her blood, made her feel she would follow him to victory against overwhelming odds. At the moment, she found it alarming.
Captain, Tolvern tried again. You're not considering...
The antidote is gone for now,
Nib Pim said.
Henry Upton was either destroyed or taken in tow to Hot Balsa. But where? We can't exactly search millions of square miles of cane swamp and jungle.
The captain shook his head. Actually, you're wrong. I know exactly where it is. The other two leaned forward in anticipation, but before Drake could elaborate, Jane's voice came through the general comlink.
30 minutes to jump.
The rest will have to wait, Drake said. We need that nav chip on. The three of them rose. Tolvern will take you to the sickbay, Drake said. At no time will you stroll about unescorted, like you did when you showed up in engineering. Is that understood? Nib Pim's mouth drew into a straight line, the lips tight.
Yes, sir.
I trust you as my pilot, but I do not in any way trust that you're cured of addiction. That makes you a danger to yourself and to us, and that's where my loyalty to you ends.
Yes, sir,
Nib Pim said. To be clear, anyone who passes you a single grain of sugar will be shot, and you will condemn yourself to slavery, this time for good. Not that I expect either of those facts to keep you from dipping into the white stuff should the opportunity present itself. Indeed, from the way the Hroom's tongue passed over his lips, she could see that the mere talk of sugar had him thinking about it again. The captain turned to her now. Watch him carefully. Keep yourself armed at all times. If he does anything that puts your or anyone else's life in danger, take immediate action. Lethal action, if necessary.
Yes, sir. I won't mess around.
She fixed Nib Pim with a sharp look that would hopefully let him know that she was serious, and would thus dissuade him from any funny business the moment such a thought crossed his mind. For now, he looked as harmless as a gangly, overgrown child, but she remembered how he'd flung himself at the door to his cell. She would not take him or his addiction lightly. Chapter 16. Tolvern scanned the bar for Cap and Carvalho, but couldn't see them anywhere in the sweaty, spice-smelling crowd that danced and swayed to the music pounding through the bar speakers. It mingled with the sound of the rooftop bars on the buildings to either side, which one could reach via rope and plank bridges that served as roads at nighttime. It was claimed that crocodile-like creatures came out of the river at night, and it wasn't safe below. Didn't seem to be safe above, either. San Pablo was a low-gravity world, felt like about 60% from what her bones were telling her, and giant winged shapes soared in the crimson sky overhead, each with a wingspan of 15-20 feet. They had faces like bats and feathers like birds. An oily film coated her tongue from the charcoal fires and burning petroleum that permeated the air over the city. It was so thick, humid, and pungent that she could scarcely breathe. And the heat, it was sweltering up here and suffocating down below. There were still Hroom on the planet. The entire eastern continent was still theirs, and where the humans had built, they reused the relics of the aliens who had come before. The port of San Pablo itself was built atop an ancient Hroom metropolis, and everywhere you looked, you could see spectacular stone ruins. One of their vast ziggurats,
A temple of some kind, the captain had told her upon their arrival, loomed above them to the north. To the west, toward the river, lay the red palm forests that surrounded one of their ancient palace complexes, its courtyards visible if you stood in a certain place. With the golden sun dropping over the red forested mountain range opposite the river, the rooftop terrace presented an amazing view, but none of the humans or whom at the bar paid it any attention. Wrong crowd for that, she supposed.
"Hey, Commander!" Cap called.
Tolvern sighed with relief to spot Cap and Carvalho and made her way over. The pair sat near the edge of the building, away from the dancing where it was quieter. They'd changed out of space garb. Carvalho wore black leather pants and a vest with no shirt under it, which showed off his bulging muscles. He wore gold hoops in his earlobes and dark eyeliner. Cap wore tight pants and a leather vest of her own that was unzipped to show her cleavage. Carvalho draped an arm over her shoulder, his hand resting casually against one breast. Tolvern glanced down at her own simple jumpsuit. Not a uniform exactly, but it sure looked like one compared to what these two were wearing. "Thanks a lot, Captain," she thought, as she stiffly took a seat next to them. Drake, Barker, and Oglethorpe were out having fun at the space yards, haggling over repairs to Ajax, which they'd left in orbit above. She'd thought to go with them, but when Drake had heard that Cap had invited her into town to join her and Carvalho, he'd told her to go keep an eye on the pair. Cap looked her over.
"So, this is what passes for casual where you're from."
"Where I'm from is the Royal Navy. I don't get out much for shore leave, so I don't have much use for casual clothing."
"That your idea? Or the captain's?"
"I don't have much use for it," Tolvern said. "Anyway, the captain usually stays on ship, too, unless he can go hunting."
"Hunting?"
"Big game, mostly. I've been with him a few times."
"And how is it, anyway? The hunting, has Drake got a big shotgun or what?"
Cap grinned at Carvalho, who flashed a toothy smile.
"Like I would know,"
Tolvern said with a snort.
"You should. I can see you want to jump him."
"No, I don't. That's against regulations."
Tolvern glanced significantly at Carvalho, though she was aware that making an issue of it now made her look childish. Cap slapped Carvalho's thigh.
"Go get us something to drink. We're bloody thirsty here."
The man sprang obediently to his feet. When he was gone, Cap pulled her chair over to Tolvern's. She glanced at a pair of Hroom arm wrestling at the next table, then leaned in with a conspiratorial look, putting a hand on Tolvern's knee like they were old pals.
"You come to keep an eye on me, or you looking to get laid? Couple of blokes been checking you out since you came in, but you gotta loosen up if you know what I mean."
Tolvern resisted the urge to ask who and where, even as she knew Cap was full of it. Instead, she shrugged.
"Neither. I got sick of babysitting the pilot, so I jumped at the chance to come down and grab a drink. Relax a little."
"Ah, he ain't so bad anyhow."
"Nib Pym?"
Tolvern asked.
I didn't think nothing good of him when he showed up on the bridge. Figured he'd be a real ass, looked down on me and all. But nah, he's a good bloke, considering. What being an alien and all."
"Got us here, all right,"
Carvalho said, returning with three glasses that looked too big to possibly hold distilled liquor.
"And I figure this is where some of us wanted to be all along. I might just stay if this rum is any good."
He took a big swig.
"And it is."
A roar disrupted the scene, a disturbance at the next table over. Two men poured sugar onto the ground, and several Hroom threw themselves down to scarf at it, with their long tongues snaking out like anteaters devouring termites. A man staggered past, crashing into tables. Someone gave him a kick to the backside as he stumbled through, and this brought a laugh, thus proving that humans didn't need sugar. The liquid stuff that had been around since time immemorial seemed to do the same trick. Tolvern took a drink. The rum burned going down, and she told herself to take it easy. She'd make a roaring fool of herself if she wasn't careful. Then these two would go off to work God knows what mischief, while she did her own stumbling into tables. "What do you think?" Cap asked. "The black fellow, or the big pile of muscle over there?" "For her or you," Carvalho said. "Got my eye on someone else if you don't satisfy me," she said. "For Tulvern." "Black fellow is better looking," Carvalho said. "That other bloke is missing half his teeth. Course he does have them muscles you was talking about, and the commander is so bloody stiff she might need some muscles to loosen her up." "Anyhow, look," Cap said. "They both got ladies checking him out. What do you think, is our girl better looking?"
"Hard to say. She ain't exactly dressed up to get lucky, if you know what I mean."
Tulvern had been blushing through this, feeling awkward, as they discussed her so casually. She'd been sure they were inventing both men from whole cloth to get her to look. But at the mention of the other women involved in this supposed competition for attention, she glanced over. Both of the men were sitting at the bar, huge tankards of beer in hand. One was dark and lean. The other had a shock of red hair, a beard, and muscles. The one with the beard wasn't missing any teeth that she could see. Both men looked plenty handsome. Tulvern took another drink of rum.
"You're full of it, both of you. They're not looking this way." "Course they wouldn't be, with you all zipped up like that," Cap said. "Come on, you're pretty enough. Even if you ain't looking, because I know you got your eye on that big game hunter of yours. It don't hurt to have fun, does it?"
She reached over for the zipper of Tulvern's jumpsuit and tugged it straight down. It was playful enough, and not mean-spirited, and Tulvern had downed just enough rum that she was no longer feeling so uptight. The other woman unzipped her suit halfway to her navel, until a strip of bare flesh passed right between her breasts.
"Well, look at that," Cap said with another grin. "I ain't even got a bra on. You're ready to take it all off. Just need permission, eh?"
This made Tulvern feel self-conscious again. She had a slender, almost boyish figure, with small breasts. Didn't really need a bra. Not the envious combination of lean and yet still curvy that Henny Cap seemed to carry effortlessly. Most of the men glancing this way, she now noticed, as she was looking around the bar, were looking at Cap, not her. She zipped her jumper back up with an exaggerated sigh, trying to cover her embarrassment with a look of indifference. She didn't zip it all the way, but mostly.
"Oh, you ain't off bad, Tulvern."
Cap's hand slid up Carvalho's thigh.
"When I met you, I thought you had the biggest stick up your backside I'd ever seen." "It's still there, you just can't see it, because my butt cheeks are clenched too tight. This place makes me nervous."
The other woman laughed and tossed back the rest of her rum. She fished out a couple of silver shillings, which she slapped on the table, then patted Carvalho's cheek.
"Get us another round, love."
He rose obediently and made his way to the bar. It might take a minute. There were a crowd of men and women struggling to get the barman's attention.
"I can ditch him at any time, you know," Cap said. "You want to get lucky tonight? Let me know, and we'll jump those two blokes at the bar." "Wouldn't your boyfriend be furious?"
Cap shrugged. "Nah, he'd take it as a license to find some bar wench and take her upstairs. What do you say?" Tulvern had already had a snootful of rum and was starting to feel warm and reckless. She cast her glance at the two men. They were looking at her this time, and one of them leaned in to whisper something in his mate's ear. The man glanced at her and winked. She looked away, feeling flushed.
"You pick first," Cap said. "Mr. Muscles or the Dark One?" "They're probably pirates."
"So are we."
"It's not that I'm not..."
Tulvern's voice trailed off.
"Horny?"
"Curious. I'm curious. But, well, no, I don't think so. Not tonight."
Just as quickly, the reckless feeling dissolved into the thick air.
"I knew it," Cap said, nodding sagely. "You're hot for the captain. Well, believe me, you ain't getting far with that one. Not the way you're playing coy and all. You want that man, you'll have to jump his bones."
She looked toward the bar, irritation flickering across her face.
"Where is our rum? I'm dying of thirst here."
Tolvern's job was to keep an eye on Cap and Carvalho, not get herself smashed. But the other woman kept ordering up the rum. Tolvern was already feeling wobbly when Cap and Carvalho dragged her to the dance floor, where the three of them joined the sweating, writhing bodies. She wasn't a great dancer under the best of circumstances, and with so much rum in her belly, she knew she was flailing about ridiculously. Cap grabbed her wrist and pulled her deeper in, and soon she was in so tight with other bodies that her rhythm, or lack thereof, didn't matter so much. At last, she was so hot and sweaty and drunk that she had to come out to take a break. She ordered a mineral water at the bar, and then went looking for a washroom. She pushed through a circle of whom smoking a water pipe, through a mixed group of whom and human playing some sort of dice game, and then through a crowd packed in near the washroom entrance. She staggered past the men and whom at a long trough-like urinal, and pushed herself into the stall. A wave of nausea washed over her as she sat, but it passed. She remembered something her father had said once when she'd had too much Christmas eggnog and complained of a hangover. After the first glass, you were only borrowing future happiness. Soon enough, you'd have to pay it back with interest. What's more, as she'd been recently accepted into the academy at the time, getting drunk was the quickest way to remind others that she was a commoner. A baron's son might get away with it, but if she got drunk in public, people of better breeding would shake their heads and remind themselves that she was a steward's daughter. Tolvern stood and stared down as the bowl emptied and refilled with rust-colored water. The swirling looked like how her stomach felt. "No more rum," she mumbled. When she came out of the bathroom, two whom were on the floor fighting, while humans and other whom surrounded them, making bets, passing money. The brawlers had the light pink skin of eaters, and she figured it was something over sugar. Carvalho stood to one side with another man, short and bald, one ear clipped. The two men stood in close, exchanging something, one palm to the other. Tolvern figured it was another bet on the fighting room, but then the bald man reached into a pocket and removed a heavy coin purse. Carvalho pulled apart the string and peered inside, his eyes widening. He quickly drew the string and shoved it into a pocket. He leaned in and whispered to the bald man, who nodded before slipping furtively away. She stared hard. The bald man. She'd seen him before, and suddenly remembered where. He was one of the men she'd led in a surly procession from the captured pirate frigate. Drake had forced the pirates to sign papers renouncing their rights to their ship in return for the privilege of being spared their lives. The captain and his daughter had muttered dark oaths, but they had signed, together with the rest of the crew. Hadn't Carvalho and Cap been in the party that handcuffed the prisoners and sent them to the space elevator to be unceremoniously dumped onto the surface? Tolvern thought they had. She shrank into the crowd as Carvalho turned to scan his surroundings. That was a big coin purse. If stuffed with guineas and half-crowns, it might hold several hundred pounds. What the devil had Carvalho given or told the bald man to get a payoff of that size? Then, while she was still standing there trying not to be seen, another figure picked her way through the crowd to Carvalho's side. Cap. The two of them embraced, but it wasn't for amorous purposes. Instead, Carvalho leaned in and whispered in her ear. In response to whatever he'd said, she reached out a hand and patted his bulging pocket where he'd stuffed the coin purse. Tolvern retreated into the bathroom, her heart pounding, her face flushed with rage at the betrayal. Chapter 17. A whom strapped the four passengers into the railgun car. Drake and Tolvern in the front seats, Barker and Oglethorpe in the back. Harnesses swung over their shoulders to hold them in place, as if they were in an amusement park roller coaster. Drake looked doubtfully at the track that cut at a near vertical angle into the hazy red mist. He could just see the distant tower that marked the cars of the space elevator, where they would dock and continue their journey into space, where Ajax waited. The Hroom spoke in Ladino with a greasy-handed female operator, then turned to the four passengers.
"There is a technical issue. We expect it to be resolved in 2 minutes."
"One of these days," Barker said from behind Drake's shoulder, "this thing is going to launch right off the tracks."
"What makes you think it hasn't already?" Drake said.
The elevator itself was several centuries old, Hroom Empire tech from before the wars. Composed of the counterweight of a small moon in orbit and a carbon nanotube structure stretching to the ground, it had once whisked passengers and goods back and forth from terra firma to space, saving a fortune on fuel to lift mass out of San Pablo's gravity well. Civilization had collapsed on the world not long after the Ladino settlers, themselves a mixture of Brazilians, Argentines, and Spaniards, had migrated out from the home systems. Several decades ago, the lower machinery had failed, as had attempts to repair it. Albion engineers could have built a new elevator at great cost, but the present solution was this railgun to launch passengers up to the lowest functioning levels of the elevator. None of them had done it before. Drake would have brought Ajax and Captain Kidd down from orbit, but he'd needed to suss out the situation on the ground first, make sure they could get in and out safely. Until he knew, he wouldn't bring the ship planetside where it would be vulnerable. After several minutes, the Hroom came back from the small stone building housing the control equipment for the railgun. He popped to open the canopy.
"Excuse me, the problem should be resolved shortly."
"How long?" Drake asked.
5 minutes, perhaps 10.
The Hroom left without shutting the canopy. Tolvern cleared her throat. She still looked pale from her drinking of the previous evening.
"This is the point where Jane would say, recalculating, and then fall into an endless loop. Recalculating, recalculating, recalculating."
"I just want it over with,"
Oglethorpe groaned from the back seat.
"Have you thought anything more about what I told you, Captain?"
Tolvern asked.
"I have. I'm looking for other explanations."
"It was a lot of money. Must have been hundreds of pounds."
"But you didn't see it."
"It was heavy," she insisted.
"Had
to be a lot, even if only shillings. What could that mean? You and I both know that there's not a blessed thing of value in our possession, except the ships themselves."
He knew that. He'd spent the day yesterday haggling with spaceport operators. The initial findings were discouraging. Turns out this sector of space was awash with equipment left kicking around after the war. Captain Kidd's plasma engine hadn't fetched £10,000, or even 8 as Barker had suggested, but 6. The rest of the ship would bring just under 4,000 more, 2,500 if he insisted on stripping out the weapon systems first. He'd wanted to keep both arms and armaments, but needed that money. So, 10,000 quid tops for repairs that would have taken 30,000 to do properly in Royal Navy space yards with Navy contractors. But the good news was that if the wrecks themselves were going cheap, so was labor. Navy contracts had dried up with the end of the war. He'd found 2 different yards that bid hard and fast for the right to repair Ajax. What's more, the master boatwright at 1 yard offered to trade the hulk of Captain Kidd, minus engines, against the cost of the shield repair. The yard owner would use some of the wreck to complete the patches and keep the rest. The end result would look like the unholy offspring of a Punisher-class cruiser and a pirate frigate, but they'd be back in fighting trim. And Drake needed them battle-ready. He meant to charge for Hot Barca the instant the repairs were done.
"The question," Drake said, "is whether Captain Vargas is scheming to get his ship back, or if he has darker plans."
"His ship is a wreck," Tolvern said. "Why would he want it back when we are practically going to deliver Ajax to him? He saw her in action, he knows what she's capable of."
"In the right hands, namely mine."
Tolvern turned her head, an eyebrow raised. That sounds like a boast. Drake allowed a half-smile. Perhaps it is. Vargas didn't show particular skill in command of his own vessel. Could be that he's used to forcing surrender on pure swagger, a pirate's fearsome reputation and all that rubbish. But I suspect he wasn't that good. It was hardly a fair fight, not like facing Rutherford.
We bested Rutherford, too, Tolvern said.
Aye, that we did, Barker said from behind them. But some of that was the element of surprise.
Bested him twice, in fact, Tolvern said.
Would you place money on a third time? Barker asked. I'd be gobsmacked if he didn't bring a whole task force next time he comes after us. For all we know, we'll be facing the bloody dreadnought this time. You want to go up against her?
The chief engineer's more choleric assessment brought the captain some needed perspective. Drake was planning an assault on Royal Navy and York Company resources, not to mention the personal estates of Lord Malthorn himself, when at the moment he was at risk of losing his ship, and possibly his life, to a ragtag group of pirates. First he had to take care of that small detail before worrying about Rutherford and the rest.
The question for now, Drake said, is how we keep those villains from taking our ship.
Cancel shore leave, Tolvern said. Anyone who doesn't return to space is off the crew. Anyone else, from the former prisoners, I mean, we arrest as soon as they get on board.
So they're all against us, is that what you're saying?
Tolvern played with the straps on her harness.
What is Cap thinking? You promoted her. You gave her what she wanted. If only she weren't involved with that cursed Carvalho. He must have turned her.
Where is that room, anyway? Oglethorpe asked. This waiting is awful. It's so bloody hot, I'm melting. Whining isn't going to help any, Barker growled back.
The engineer was only voicing what the captain was thinking himself. Not that Oglethorpe was wrong. Drake was wrung out from the heat, and tired of lying in the rail car on his back, looking up into the hazy red sky. Somewhere up there was Ajax, and he was anxious to get back on the bridge of his ship.
"The problem is," he said, after turning it over in his head, "we can't toss aside crew because they might be against us. I think we need to let it play out at the yards."
"How are we going to do that?" Tolvern said. "Say Vargas paid off Carvalho to get us out of the way. Carvalho takes some upfront money, finds fools in the city who are short on money and long on weapons and free time. Could be 20 men coming after us."
"In that case," Drake said, "I'd say we buy our own muscle."
"With what?" Tolvern said. "What will we have once we are done paying those thieves at the yard?"
"Not much," Drake agreed. "But we have a bit. And the promise of a whole lot more. People see us hauling the sorry carcass of Captain Kidd planetside. See Ajax come thundering down, her guns bristling. They'll know what we are capable of." "More piracy," Barker said. "That's what you're talking about. More pirates on board. These ones supposedly replacing the unreliable ones we've already got. Is that about right?"
The room came over again, and conversation died.
"Okay," he said, sounding more cheerful. "This time we're definitely ready for launch. We thought there might be a broken segment of rail, turns out not."
"What do you mean?" Barker asked in a sharp tone. "How do you think the rail might be broken? It's either broken or it isn't."
"No worries, it's all fixed now."
With that, the room shut the plastic canopy and hurried off.
"Are you sure we can't stay here forever?" Oglethorpe asked. "All of a sudden it doesn't feel so hot."
A buzzing traveled along the rails beneath them. The rail car vibrated. It felt suddenly very small and fragile, the hazy lines of the space elevator so distant, and the rail beneath them as slender as a ribbon of glass.
"Here we go," Barker said in a low voice. "King's balls."
They launched. One moment, Drake was lying on his back, motionless, his heart picking up speed. The next, a giant fist slammed into his chest, and he was hurtling upward. Oglethorpe screamed, a long wail of
"Ah!"
that seemed to go on forever. Drake had traveled at 20,000 miles a second, but this rapid acceleration, with no antigrav, With the air blasting over the capsule was a different matter. Only a few hundred miles an hour now, but still accelerating. Drake closed his eyes. The air howled outside the canopy. It didn't cut the sound of Oglethorpe's scream.
Ah!
Chapter 18. The next day, Tolvern eyed Drake as she followed him away from Ajax, which sat hissing and popping behind them on the tarmac. It was just the two of them, but the captain walked with a confident swagger, seeming not to care if they were ambushed or picked off by snipers from atop one of the surrounding warehouses or hangars. When had he become such a risk-taker, a bluffer like a high-stakes poker player? Drake wore a sidearm slung low on his hip, a long-barreled hand cannon. Tolvern had a revolver, plus a shotgun over her shoulder. She'd have brought even more weaponry, but Drake didn't want them entering the yard like they were expecting a fight. Well, weren't they?
Miss Cap? She asked.
Sitting with a big old pile of money waiting for us in the hangar.
Together with about 20 other pirates, I should figure.
We'll see. He didn't sound concerned.
Meanwhile, someone comes and grabs Ajax while we're inside messing around.
Drake gave her a side look. Anyone tries to storm the ship and the deck gun will settle their hash in short order. Trucks came rolling across the tarmac toward Ajax, ready to haul her into the largest of the hangars, a vast warehouse where men and room and equipment would spend the next 2 weeks assisting Ajax's own bosuns in patching her up. Ajax stretched long and dark and mean-looking beneath the ruddy, soot-stained sky over San Pablo. Her surface was pitted and battered, but this somehow made her look only more sinister. And still a Royal Navy cruiser. Tolvern didn't fancy the thought of patching her with parts salvaged from Captain Kidd. Whatever came out the other side, it would be ugly. The space yard was so large that it took 10 minutes to walk across the tarmac, dodging support vehicles and smaller spacecraft, until they reached the vast open doors of the yard's second-largest hangar. Inside lay Captain Kidd. She'd looked a proper wreck when Cap untethered and dropped her into the atmosphere, bandaged with temporary foam shields, just so she could survive the heat of re-entry. Now she looked pathetic, like an abandoned derelict floating in the abyss of deep space, barely fit for salvage. Workers swarmed over the hull of the captured pirate ship, a dozen blowtorches cutting away chunks of shielding and the paneling beneath, which were lifted away by cranes to be stacked in one corner. Workers there numbered and labeled the pieces, which ranged in size from a few square feet to vast segments that, once removed, revealed the passages and interior chambers. The biggest crane of all was secured to Captain Kidd's plasma engine, which it strained to lift clear. The chains went taut until it looked like they would snap. The entire back end of the wreck started to lift, and workers atop the ship shouted and cursed as they were nearly bucked off. There was no net and little safety equipment of any kind. Turned out the engine hadn't been completely cut free of the ship, so they sent in a pair of Hroom with blowtorches to finish the job. A tall, bony man, almost built like a Hroom himself, spotted them and came over. He was one of the few wearing a hard hat, and as he approached, he took it off and ran a hand along his buzzed, glistening scalp. Sweat stained his armpits.
"This is Commander Tolvern, my first mate," Drake said to him. To Tolvern he said, "Hubert Rodriguez. He owns this place."
She took the sweating, greasy hand Rodriguez offered, but wiped her hand on the back of her leg as soon as the man turned back to the captain.
"Wasn't pleased to see your friends show up at the yard this morning," the man said in Ladino-accented English. "I know some of these people, cutthroats and thieves."
He drew out this last word, "thieves."
"Believe me," Drake said, "I'd rather have 50 Royal Marines to back me up. It doesn't seem that any are forthcoming."
Tolvern cast her eye about for the woman Drake had entrusted to take the captured ship down to the yard.
"Where is Henny Cap?"
"Waiting in my office," Rodriguez said.
she won't let our hand off the money bag.
I'll bet, Tolvern said with a grunt. Question is, you got anyone keeping an eye on her?
Two of my men, the money is safe for now. I would not put down a long-term wager, however. Not if you have run afoul of Captain Vargas. He has a fearsome reputation.
I've taken that reputation from him, Drake said with a nod toward the dissolving wreckage of the pirate's former ship.
We will see.
Against Tolvern's better judgment, Drake had confided with the head of the yards. Rodriguez had too much money in this operation to be turning against legitimate customers. Sure, he could score a quick payoff if he betrayed them, but then who would trust him with their ship? What's more, there was the promise of bigger prizes to come if he got Captain Drake fixed up and out working mischief again.
Anyway, I have not seen any sign of Vargas or his crew, Rodriguez continued, as the three of them made their way to a metal staircase that snaked its way up to a catwalk that hooked over to his offices overlooking the hangar. He knows this is neutral territory. If there is any fighting, San Pablo will be close to him, now and forevermore.
He's desperate, Tolvern said.
She cast her eye across the hangar, looking for suspicious movement, anyone who seemed to be paying them unusual attention.
Figure he'd trade one friendly port for a fresh ship and a chance for revenge.
They walked across the catwalk and entered Rodriguez's office. A wave of cool, filtered air washed over them, and Tolvern took big gulps, grateful to be away from the smell of lubricant and solvents, and the muggy, smoggy atmosphere of San Pablo itself. Cap sat behind a metal desk, her tattooed forearm resting over a heavy sack of coins, her sidearm on the desk beside her. A computer screen hung from one wall, showing the outlines of the pirate ship and movement of cranes and workers, but she paid it no attention. Instead, she stared at two men in brown jumpsuits who were armed with shotguns and standing in either corner of the room.
"You see," Rodriguez said, not to Drake and Tolvern, but to Cap, "I was not going to turn over the money and then steal it back from you." "I ain't so sure of that," she said. "You might have sent your goons to rob me, then claim they went all rogue and crap."
A nod.
"Hey, Captain, Commander."
Tolvern stared at the woman.
"Where's your friend?"
"Who? You mean Carvalho?" She shrugged. "He's about, somewhere in the city, I figure."
"Right."
She let the skepticism come through in her voice. Cap frowned. Drake looked around. "Nothing looks amiss here." Then to Cap, "We all need to be cautious. Come back to Ajax with us."
"What, you don't want me to stay with Captain Kidd, keep an eye on things as they take her apart?"
"We have a lot of money here, and that makes us a target for robbery," Drake said. "Better if we stick together, in case there's an ambush, you know. And I'm not talking about from Rodriguez or his men."
Something passed over Cap's face. It wasn't confusion. She'd picked up what the captain was insinuating.
"Wait a minute. What are you saying?"
Tolvern put her hand on her sidearm.
"Stand up, Cap. Keep your hands where I can see them."
Cap cursed. She started to move.
"Touch that weapon and I'll blow you to hell,"
Tolvern warned.
"Do what she says,"
the captain said in his stern voice, sounding to Tolvern's ears like his father, the Baron. Cap stood and pushed away from the money and the desk. Anger and betrayal flashed over her face. Tolvern wondered if she could have got it wrong. What had she seen 2 nights ago in the city? Could she have misread the situation and Carvalho and Cap hadn't received a hefty payoff for betraying them to the pirates?
"I don't want bloodshed," Rodriguez said, as Tolvern moved toward Cap with her gun leveled. "If you're going to kill traitors, do it on your own turf, not my spaceyard."
"I hope bloodshed will be unnecessary," Drake said. Cap blanched at this talk. She didn't move as Tolvern groped her from head to toe. Tolvern lifted the other woman's trouser leg and removed a long dagger strapped to her shin. But there were no other weapons or items of interest. She didn't know what she'd expected, but again she had the sense that she'd made a mistake. Drake took Cap's gun and handed it to Tolvern as the commander backed away from the desk.
Go ahead, sit down, he told Cap. We'll do this in a civilized manner.
I don't deserve this, Cap said. I did everything you said. I was guarding the money, didn't take none of it.
It's not the money in front of you that's the issue, Tolvern said. It's the payoff you received the other night.
What do you mean?
Cap's voice was sullen.
Commander, tell her, Drake said.
Tolvern explained how she'd come out of the washroom to see Carvalho receiving a purse stuffed with coins, hundreds of pounds worth, it seemed. The Ladino had tucked this away, then apparently shared whatever information he had with Cap. There was a long pause when Tolvern finished.
Yeah, there's money, but it ain't what you think.
I hope not, Drake said. He sounded stern but sincere. But you can see how it looks very bad, as if you sold us out, took payment from one of Captain Vargas's men. What is the plan to give him Ajax? Were you going to kill us to ease the way?
No! No what? Tolvern said. The killing part or the part about Vargas paying you off? All of that, I swear to God, it was some money some bloke owed me. Owed us, I mean, from way back when.
Tolvern scoffed.
We're not idiots. You're trying to claim you show up your first night in San Pablo, and some honest creditor seeks you out at a bar, anxious to settle an old debt.
Cap didn't answer.
I'm losing my patience, Drake said. I don't want you to be guilty. I want there to be a good explanation. I'm short on crew, and I can't be tossing people for no reason, especially not one who showed she could be useful, like you did. That's why I promoted you. That's why I told you to start finding me a crew.
I'm obliged, I really am. I wouldn't do you no wrong, Captain, please.
Cap sounded sincere, and Tolvern wanted to believe her. Carvalho was a scoundrel, but the commander had been warming to this former marine with the rough speech and swagger.
But I won't have traitors in my crew, Drake said. I won't be lied to.
It's the crew you told me to raise.
Yes, Drake said.
I started putting out the word, and it turned out that there were plenty who wanted to join. City is swarming with them. A lot of tramp merchants put out of business, smugglers and the like, who lost their ships in the war. I thought, well, instead of collecting names to pass on, I'd get people to pay a little something to get on the list, know what I mean? Couple of coins here, couple there. Carvalho knew this bloke, see, who knew other blokes.
Let me get this straight, Drake said. He still sounded stern, but some of the tension had dissolved from his voice. You were ordered to find me the best sorts for the mission. 100 names and I'd choose 30 of them. Instead, you were going to recommend anyone willing to press a few coins in your palm.
Aye, she said. It weren't no hundreds of pounds, though. Half a crown to get on the list. 2 quid if you found yourself chosen. But I swear, I didn't mean no harm.
Listen up, Tolvern said. She was both angry and relieved.
We're still a military ship, and we follow military discipline. You'll receive your pay according to military grades. There will be no bribe on this or any other matter.
Rodriguez let out a chuckle behind them.
Glad to hear you don't have a traitor on your hands, my friends. But if I were you, I'd lighten up on your military discipline. None of these malvados are rushing to join your crew because they want 3 square meals and navy wages.
What do you mean?
Tolvern asked.
People heard how you took down Captain Kidd, how you put Vargas in his place. They figure you'll soon be hauling in the booty, and they want a piece of the action. That means pirate rules, captain share, first mate share, and so on down to the cabin boy. They want coin in palm, preferably gold, and a lot of it.
A shadow passed over Drake's face. Tolvern also felt troubled. The captain handed her Cap's firearm, which she was about to return to the woman, when an explosion sounded from the hangar outside the office. Rodriguez cursed in Ladino. He turned for the door, perhaps thinking, as had Tolvern, that some careless worker had stumbled across some unexploded ordnance and set it off. But when he threw open the door, gunfire came blasting up at them. Chapter 19. For some reason, the spaceyard owner's words disturbed Drake more than the revelation that Cap
had been taking a little illicit profit from filling the crew list. That bit about men and women signing on so they could get gold. Shouldn't have been a surprise, so why was it bothering him so much? He was so deep in his thoughts that the explosion blended into the background clank and boom of the hangar floor. It was only when the two guards grabbed Rodriguez and dragged him back to safety in the office that Drake realized that they were under attack. Bullets slammed into the windows overlooking the hangar. The windows were thick plastisteel, bomb-proof against the accidents that must be common in the operation taking place outside, and they didn't shatter. Drake drew his sidearm and looked down at the hangar floor. A dozen or more armed men and women swarmed in through a gaping hole in the far side of the hangar. They'd blasted through the outer wall instead of facing the guards at the open hangar doors. Now the intruders exchanged gunfire with the men at the doors, while the workers took cover among the equipment or fled for their lives. Three men lay dead on the floor, already gunned down by the attackers, and he saw with alarm that these were some of the ones he'd hired to help guard Captain Kidd in the hangar. One of the attackers stood over their bodies, spraying machine gun fire across the hangar, and it was this that had apparently struck the window. They hadn't yet been targeted. Rodriguez dragged the door shut and shouted instructions to his men, who looked nervous. He drew his own sidearm, a big, ugly thing with a bone handle and a long, black barrel. Drake turned on Cap, his suspicions blooming anew.
"Who are they?" he demanded.
"I don't know, I swear."
She sounded afraid, legitimately confused.
"Give me my gun so I can fight."
Tolvern had been on the verge of handing over the gun, but whipped it back.
"Get in the corner," she told Cap. "Drop to your knees. Do not move or I'll waste you, got it?"
Drake turned back to the window. He searched the attackers for Carvalho, half convinced that Cap's partner would be leading the assault, but couldn't see the big Ladino.
"Here they come," Tolvern said. "Up the stairs."
He followed her gaze. Several attackers came sprinting up the metal stairs toward the catwalk. They carried hand cannons, assault rifles, shotguns, and pistols, and they were festooned with bandoliers stuffed with grenade shells or heavy-caliber bullets. One man was missing an arm that had been replaced with a shining mechanical limb with a Gatling gun on the end. The attackers gained the catwalk and started toward the offices. When they were halfway across, a woman dropped to her knee and lifted a long-nosed hand cannon. Rodriguez spat something in Ladino. His men fell back from the window, and Drake and Tolvern followed. A grenade slammed into it, and the window shuddered. The smoke outside cleared to reveal a spiderweb of cracks along its surface. Drake took stock of their own weapons, a few pistols, plus the shotguns held by Tolvern and Rodriguez's guards. That might serve if the enemy closed in, but not if they kept shooting grenades from a distance. And if Drake and the others made a run for it, the attackers had rifles as well. The enemy could pick them off as they fled around the catwalk. Another shot, this one against the other window, then a third which battered the door. Smoke seeped into the room. Outside, gunfire continued across the hangar. The ground shuddered from a thumping explosion. Drake could only presume that by now the attackers had either overwhelmed or driven off any of the defenders on the hangar floor.
"How many armed men do you have in the yard?" Drake asked Rodriguez.
"Not enough, 15-20, but they're spread out over 3 square miles. We've had thieves before, lone desperados, nothing like this. I told you, people know if they're dumb enough to..."
Another explosion hit the window. A piece of plastisteel cracked loose and clattered to the ground. The sound of gunfire came through, louder than ever. Had to be Vargas. The pirate had a whole crew of desperados, men from whom Drake had stripped their possessions and livelihood. Vargas must have known he couldn't take Ajax directly, not with crew still on board and manning the weapons. But if he could kill the captain and first mate while they were unprotected, perhaps even take the owner of the spaceyard hostage, then he'd stand good odds. Drake cast a side glance at Cap, who had risen from the floor during the last attack to grab her dagger from the table. Perspiration stood out on her forehead and buzzed scalp. Was she behind this, or surprised like the rest of them?
"Give her the gun," he told Tolvern.
But, Captain...
If she's against us, she'll shoot us in the back, but we're probably dead anyway. He paused as another blast hit the window. More plastisteel broke away. We've got to get out of here before they cave it in around us.
Tolvern held out the gun slowly. Cap snatched it back with a glower. She shoved the dagger into its hilt and checked the gun's magazine.
Where does the catwalk lead? Drake asked Rodriguez. Are there more stairs?
It takes you around the other side of the pirate ship. No stairs that way. But we could climb onto the crane and scramble down the side of the ship.
Good enough. The rest of you listen up. This is what we are going to do.
Drake gave quick instructions to get them in order, then knocked upon the door with his shoulder and lurched onto the catwalk. Tolvern and Cap came in behind, followed by Rodriguez and his two guards. All six of them emerged, shooting. The distance was too great for shotguns to be accurate, but Tolvern and Rodriguez's men made a good show of it anyway, blasting away, pumping, and firing again. The enemy threw themselves to the catwalk to avoid the fire, and Drake and his companions took advantage of the delay to race around the catwalk, which continued along the wall halfway to the main doors before spanning the floor to the other side of the hangar. The partially dismantled hull of Captain Kidd lay beneath them, too far to jump to on this side. Where the workers had peeled back the carapace, one could see the snaking corridors, the crew berths, and the officer quarters. Exposed wiring and conduits lay everywhere. Some of the spaceyard laborers had taken refuge inside, where Froom and human alike cowered to wait out the fighting. The attackers had nearly taken control of the hangar floor, with the remaining defenders holed up in a redoubt to one side, behind one of the cranes. They returned scattered gunfire against the men and women still moving toward them. Several men and Froom lay dead and dying across the floor. Renewed gunfire lashed at Drake and his companions before they could get around to the other side, where they could duck behind the highest point of Captain Kidd. One of Rodriguez's men cried out and fell. His fellow guard tried to drag him to safety, but bullets pinged off the rail and chased him back. The fallen man was lying motionless anyway. Seemed that a rifle shot had punched him in the chest, and Drake doubted anything could be done for him. Tolvern tossed aside her shotgun and joined Cap to rise with pistols and squeeze off shots over the top of the ship. This kept the attackers from charging across the exposed catwalk. While the two women fired, Drake eyed the crane to see if it would serve to get them down. One could, in fact, lean over, grab the metal framing, and climb to the hangar floor. Unfortunately, there was shouting back and forth between some of the enemies below and the ones on the catwalk opposite. Two of the men on the floor were loading hand cannons to blast up at their position. Drake and Rodriguez aimed through the slats in the catwalk and drove them off, at least temporarily.
"Vargas!" Rodriguez spat. "Over there, look!"
Drake spotted the pirate captain now, his familiar profile with the long graying hair and the braided beard with drooping mustache. He stood with his back to them, directing the attack on the remaining hangar defenders near the main doors. Tolvern pointed her pistol at the pirate. Drake shouted at her to go after the men with the hand cannons instead. Neither shot was easy, but Vargas had to be 200 yards away and partially shielded by his men. She didn't obey. Instead, she squeezed off a shot at Vargas, which drew the pirate captain's attention, and fresh gunfire from him and his men. Bullets pinged off the catwalk, the walls behind, and the ship. Cap cried out and clutched her leg. Only grazed. She was shooting again seconds later. Now they were beset from three directions, from across the catwalk, from Vargas and his men, and from the two with the hand cannons below, who had enough covering fire to emerge from behind the debris where they ducked moments earlier. Drake, Rodriguez, Tolvern, Cap, and the remaining guard fought back, but they no longer had the concentrated firepower to force any of their enemies to take cover. Just when it seemed things couldn't get worse, some 18 or 20 newcomers came running in through the open hangar doors, brandishing weapons. At first, Drake's heart leaped, thinking that the fresh forces could only be reinforcements for the beleaguered defenders. Maybe they were Rodriguez's men from elsewhere in the yard,
or maybe word had reached Ajax, and Barker had sent out all available forces, though it didn't seem as though enough time had passed. Then he caught a better look. They weren't guards or other regular forces, but another mismatched hodgepodge collection of men and women, even a few whom, armed with all manner of pistols, assault rifles, grenades, and other non-standard weapons. They wore everything from jumpsuits to the leather vests favored by smugglers and pirates. It would appear that the only reinforcements would be Captain Vargas's. Ronaldo Carvalho swaggered in at their head. He brandished a heavy assault rifle and wore holsters with pistols and hand cannons, a belt of grenades going over one shoulder. The fool was overweighed with weapons and ammo, but then again, the battle was already as good as won.
"Now you'll get it, you bastards," Cap said.
A grin spread across her face. Tolvern turned on her, sputtering, her face red with rage.
"Why, you treacherous!"
She lifted her gun. Drake shot out a hand and grabbed her wrist. Cap was looking down at Vargas and his men. Her taunt hadn't been meant for them. It was directed toward the pirates. At that moment, Carvalho opened up with his assault rifle. It sprayed gunfire toward Vargas's men, who threw themselves down. In an instant, the battle had flared up with renewed intensity. Vargas directed all his fire against Carvalho and his men. This gave Drake and the others the opportunity to focus on the enemies on the opposite side of the catwalk. They brought down two of them and forced a larger retreat. His flank secured, Drake ordered them to shoot down at the hangar floor, bringing in gunfire behind. The distance was still too great to be effective, but it kept the pirates from taking cover as the newcomers pressed forward. Carvalho himself stood in the middle of it all, shooting relentlessly, with no concern for his own well-being.
"Get down, you fool!" Cap said.
Worry pinched her voice. Drake was shortly disabused of hopes for a quick victory, as Vargas reorganized against the new threat. Already three of Carvalho's men had fallen, against maybe twice that many pirates. There were still plenty of combatants on both sides, and bullets and grenades were flying everywhere. Vargas and a small knot broke free and sprinted across the floor. They were headed toward the hole in the wall where they'd blasted their way in. There must be a vehicle of some kind waiting to carry them away. As they ran, they hurled grenades behind them, which exploded into a screen of smoke and fire. They were joined by the survivors from the group that had fled the catwalk above. Other pirates were still caught in the firefight. Drake and his band had a better view of the escaping pirates. They rose, no longer concerned about return fire, and blasted down at the men and women running. Two of the fleeing attackers fell. Several others streamed out the hole in the wall and escaped. Vargas was next, too far and at a bad angle to shoot. He was at the hole. He'd get away. Tolvern steadied her pistol arm with her left hand on her right wrist. She squeezed off one final shot as Vargas reached the hole. The pirate captain fell.
"I got him!"
Tolvern's voice was high and quivering with excitement.
"I really got him!"
Cap whooped and clapped her on the shoulder, shouting across the wide expanse of the hangar,
"Vargas is dead! We got him!"
Drake laughed as he studied Tolvern still standing there with a goofy grin on her face, her eyes wide.
"I could have taken that shot 50 times and missed," she said. "All sorts of stuff in the way. He was moving. Can you believe it? What a shot!"
She was gesturing with the gun, and he pushed it to one side. "Kindly try not to blow my head off." Tolvern returned a sheepish look, and they looked back over the hangar floor. With the death of their captain and the escape of many others, the remaining pirates were throwing down weapons and surrendering. Cap poked at her leg where the bullet had cut through her trousers and grazed her thigh, then looked up with evident satisfaction of her own.
"How about now?" she said. "You two gonna trust me or what?"
It was Rodriguez's operation, and he took charge as they rounded up the prisoners and forced them to kneel on the cement floor. Rodriguez's men dragged Vargas's corpse into stack with the other bodies. The sight of their dead captain brought no visible response from the prisoners. Drake looked over the captives. There was no sign of Vargas's daughter, or of the man with a Gatling gun for a forearm. They must have escaped. When questioned, Carvalho said that he'd been in the city, scrounging up potential crew for the ship, when someone let slip that Vargas had also been hiring men. It soon came out that the pirate captain meant to attack the space yard that very day, kill or capture Drake and his crew, then hoof it off-world with Ajax. A plot born of a volatile mix of desperation and desire for revenge. Carvalho had tried to hail the ship, but it was already coming down through the atmosphere and not picking up transmissions, so he'd rounded up as many of his potential recruits as he could get and promised them a position on Ajax if they'd join in its defense. Now he was asking Drake to honor that commitment. The captain looked over Carvalho's recruits with a skeptical eye. They were a scroungy, disreputable sort, tattoos and missing fingers, gold hoops in their ears and noses, dyed hair and braided beards. One woman had lost an ear, and an older man wore an eye patch. Give them a few bandanas and pantaloons, maybe a hook for a hand or a peg leg, and they wouldn't have looked out of place on an old wooden pirate ship. Tolvern caught his eye and gave a worried shake of the head. He sighed. What choice did he have? "We'll take an oath," Drake said. "Every man, woman, and Hrum will swear it."
"What kind of oath?"
someone asked.
"Obedience to me and my rules. We keep military discipline on my ship. If you can handle that, if you want to stay alive once we are in space, that is, then you're welcome to join."
There were nods and eyes of assent. He supposed, or hoped, rather, that his own reputation and that of Ajax itself had culled the malcontents and the most bloodthirsty types, but he had no illusions that life aboard the ship going forward would be tranquil and without incident, not with these sorts making up more than half of his crew.
"There's one other regulation you all should know," he said, eyeing one of the three Hrum, her skin faded into a pale pinkish shade. "I'll have no sugar on board. No sugar for any purpose whatsoever. If anyone needs a detox, that's fine with me. Doc will do his best. Otherwise, you'll find Ajax a cold, unfriendly place for someone looking to dip his snout in the white stuff."
The eater began to edge away. Soon, she was standing back with the spaceyard workers. In contrast, the other two Hrum took a step forward, their mouths drawn into tight lines. The threat of no sugar seemed to be a feature for them, not a hardship to be endured. Any free Hrum must be living in fear of the crippling addiction that had wrecked their entire civilization. Rodriguez waved Drake over to where the prisoners knelt.
"You want to handle it yourself, or do you want me to do it?"
"Do what?" Tolvern asked, coming over with the captain. "I don't understand."
"No?" Rodriguez said. "Your captain does, I'll bet."
Drake looked over the prisoners, a cold feeling settling in his bowels like a shard of ice. There were eight of them in all, six men and two women. Gone was their swagger, the sneers they'd worn when taken prisoner. Kneeling on the hard floor, hands behind their backs, sweating while others determined their fate, they must know this was no game.
"We're going to execute them?" Tolvern asked.
One of the prisoners started to his feet at this, but two of Rodriguez's men bashed him in the back with the butts of their shotguns, and the man fell with a cry. The men kicked him in the ribs until the spaceyard owner told them to stop.
"But why?" she asked. "Once we're off this rock..."
"Tell her," Rodriguez said.
Rodriguez can't let them go, because he cannot have people thinking they can attack his yards and get away with it. Cannot have people thinking he's a soft target. You could say the same thing for us. We let these people go once. They swore an oath before we did so. Are we going to trust them now?"
"But I shot Vargas, he's dead."
"You didn't shoot his daughter," Drake said. "And others from the crew escaped. Do you want to take a chance that these villains will rejoin them?" The prisoners had heard all of this, and now began protesting in loud voices that they'd do nothing of the sort. but Drake noted that many of them were the same ones who had sworn to abandon their ship and any thoughts of revenge. Yet here it was a few days later, and they'd tried to murder him on neutral territory. Not one of these pirates had a scrap of honor, or they wouldn't be here. Rodriguez seemed alarmed as the shouting and protests continued. A woman struggled to her feet. Rodriguez drew his sidearm and shot her in the head. Another got up and lowered his head to charge. One of the guards blasted him with the shotgun. He fell back. Others cried for mercy, even as they looked like they'd tried to get up to fight or run.
"Enough," Drake said.
Rodriguez ordered his men to stand down. The remaining six pirates stopped struggling and shouting and looked at Drake with hope in their eyes. That hope faded when he drew his sidearm.
"Commander," he told Tolvern, "let's do what must be done."
Chapter 20. Tolvern struggled to sleep for several days after the fight at the spaceport hangar. It wasn't the battle itself that made her toss on her bunk at night. She'd been through all manner of terrible struggles. At the Battle of Epis III, she'd been on the bridge when the captain ordered them to land on the planet in support of the Marines. They'd flown back and forth over the surface, launching a barrage of tactical nuclear weapons over Empire forces. At the Battle of Kif Lagoon, they'd torn apart several Hroom sloops of war. Ajax had flown through the debris, side by side with Vigilant, as the two cruisers pursued the retreating enemy. Dead Hroom littered the battlefield by the thousands, floating in a macabre tableau. Tolvern had seen plenty of dead. She'd caused plenty of the dying herself. But no battle had ever ended like this. At night, when she closed her eyes, she saw the terror on her captive's face as she pressed her pistol to his temple. She felt the weight of the trigger beneath her finger. Drake had only made her kill one man. He'd taken care of the rest. But that one dead man didn't feel like an opponent killed fairly in battle. It reminded her of when her father, Lord Drake's steward, would bring in the pigs for slaughter. Pigs were not chickens. They knew they were about to be killed, could hear the screams of the other pigs and sense their terror. She'd seen the same look in the pigs' eyes that she saw in the prisoners, only this time it felt like murder. Tolvern woke on the morning of the fourth day to the sound of pounding on the other side of her stateroom wall. Sounded like a jackhammer. May as well have been knocking against her skull for all the hope she had of going back to sleep. She pulled on her jumpsuit and boots and strapped on her sidearm as she left the ship. Captain Drake stood by himself outside, staring up at his ship. Men and equipment swarmed over Ajax and across the hangar floor. Drake never moved. They all flowed around him. The doors to the hangar lay open, and a lorry, hauling a massive piece of paneling, came backing in. Men with shotguns checked his credentials before letting him pass, while other armed guards, these ones from Ajax's own crew, inspected the vehicle itself. Drake glanced at Tolvern as she approached.
"You look tired."
"I haven't been sleeping well."
"I think I know why."
"I'll tell you one thing," she said. "Waking to jackhammers outside my room doesn't help."
"Where is your room?" he asked. "Up on the bow or after the mess?"
"You've been there, remember? 12th night?"
"Ah, yes, I'd forgotten. The bow."
She looked at him. How could he not know where she slept? She'd been in that room for 3 years now. Drake nodded up toward the ship.
"That's what woke you up."
A crane was lifting a piece of deck plating to fasten down above the bridge viewscreen. It was the big plate with the skull over crossed sabers. The Jolly Roger.
"Ha, you decided to use it after all."
"Normally I'm not a gambling man, but this decision seems like a roll of the dice."
Tolvern studied him and was struck again by his aristocratic bearing. It was in the line of his jaw, his nose, his confident gaze, even the way he carried himself. She could imagine him taking over his father's barony in 10 or 20 years. His hair would be gray at the temples. There would be lines about his eyes. He would have a wife, children. Almost, she could imagine herself in that role. His companion standing at his side as an equal. But no, that was a delusion beyond fantasy. The woman he married would come from a high family. She would have a regal bearing to match Drake's. No man of his station would marry a commoner.
"What do you mean by gambling?" she asked cautiously.
"We're both at a crossroads, Commander. Don't you see it?"
"No, sir."
"My alternative is to contact Rutherford. Meet him for a parley. Share my suspicions about the Lord Admiral. See if he'll join me in a rebellion against the Admiralty. If enough join us, the King might throw his weight on our side. An antagonist in a civil war has hopes of regaining his former station in life. A traitor not so much."
She frowned.
"I find myself doubting that Rutherford, or any of them, would join a rebellion whose goal is to free the room from sugar addiction."
"No, they would not."
Tolvern glanced up at the plating with the skull and crossed sabers.
"So we go all in?"
"So I go all in. That's my crossroads. We are no longer a Punisher-class cruiser, we are something else, a hybrid. And I am no longer a captain in the Royal Navy. I have fought against king and country. I have done battle with pirates in order to steal their treasure. What does that make me?"
"A pirate, I suppose," she said.
He smiled. "Hence the Jolly Roger. Captain Drake of the starship Blackbeard. Has a certain ring to it, don't you think?"
"I've seen this coming. I think we all have. But how is this a crossroads for me?"
"I have made my choice. But you don't need to follow me."
"I see. But you always taught me loyalty, sir."
"Loyalty to Albion. This is asking you to be loyal to me. That's why I ordered you to kill that pirate, so you would understand."
"Sir?"
"Don't get me wrong. I was absolutely right that it needed to be done. Show a man mercy once, yes, but when he betrays your trust a second time, there is only one thing you can do. But as to why I told you to kill him, instead of doing it myself, you needed to see. This is the consequence of our path. Bloodshed, violence. Sooner or later, we may be the ones kneeling with hard barrels pressed to our skulls. Do you understand?"
"I think I do now, yes. You are giving me a choice. I can leave now. You will replace me with Cap or Carvalho. Is that what you want me to do? Walk away?"
"I don't need to answer that question, Tolvern."
"Yes," she insisted. "You do. Tell me what you think I should do."
"What do I think you should do?" Drake paused and looked up at the ship. He stared at it with a glazed expression, as if not really seeing it. "I think you should walk away. No. Run as fast as you can. Change your name, take a job captaining some small, anonymous tramp frigate for a few years. Make a life for yourself in the Ladino worlds. Better yet, among the new Dutch, their father from Albion. In a few years, the political situation might be different. The crown might declare an amnesty."
"I see."
Tolvern was disappointed in a way that was hard to define. She had certainly never imagined herself as a pirate. And yet...
"That's what I think you should do. What I want you to do is something else entirely."
"Please tell me."
He turned with a warm expression and put a hand on her shoulder. Her heart thudded, and it felt like her tongue had turned to cotton. She remembered what Cap had said at the bar. "You're hot for the captain." There was a reason Cap's words had irritated her, and it wasn't because the accusation was pure invention.
"I hesitate to say this," he began, then stopped.
"Captain?"
she said, and it came out as a squeak.
"Our crew is pirates, prisoners, and those too dumb to stay with the Navy when they had the chance."
He smiled as he said this last part, with affection in his voice.
"Smythe is hard to understand. Barker is an old salt, rough around the edges. There's Doc, I suppose, and a few of the engineers are clever enough. But you're my confidant, the one I can talk to.
I think of you as a friend. I hope that is acceptable.
He removed his hand from her shoulder, and the light feeling passed from her head.
Don't be a fool. What did you think he was saying?
I am happy to be a friend, she said, feeling more steady by the moment, so long as you give orders in the heat of battle.
Of course. Drake looked relieved. Then you have made your decision?
I'm sticking with you, sir. And if that means being called a pirate, I'll submit to that. But I'll need a better name. Captain Drake sounds like a pirate lord. Jess Tolvern is the name of a shopkeeper.
If that's what you're after, he said, you might need to fancy up your wardrobe. You need more flash and dazzle if you're going to look the part. Jewelry. Bright colors, you get the drift.
She nodded with mock solemnity. Do you think they sell parrots in the city?
Rodriguez came over, powering down a hand tool and tucking it into his belt, where it joined other wrenches, screwdrivers, and the like. The man wasn't the type to sit in his office, counting his guineas and doubloons. She'd seen him scrambling over the skin of the ship and crawling inside one of the engines with a plasma welder.
The bad news is you're going to be weak on your underbelly, Rodriguez said. I can't get any more pterillium. You've got 18 inches down there is all.
Nothing more to salvage from Captain Kidd? Drake asked.
Nor an ounce of this stuff. You were both shot up pretty good. I did what I could. The good news is this.
Rodriguez removed a grease-stained computer from his hip pocket. He punched a few buttons. The ship was up on her struts, and now the belly shields retracted at the yard owner's command. Three cannons emerged, black snouts menacing. The main guns of Captain Kidd, quite ingeniously installed in their own battery, on the underside of Ajax.
Anyone comes up from below and you can lay into them, Rodriguez said.
Then barrel roll and present the main broadside, Drake said. I like it.
I put in another torpedo tube as well, Rodriguez said.
He thumbed the computer and the cannon retracted.
And I've got a few other modifications yet to come. Did you ever face, how do you say, serpentinas?
Serpentines? Tolvern asked.
She remembered the corkscrewing Hroom missiles and the way they spat off dozens of smaller, impossible-to-track bomblets.
Where did you get those?
There's all sorts of interesting things kicking around the yard. I've been saving some of them for the right buyer.
She eyed the two men with rising doubts.
How much money had been left from the sale of the captured pirate frigate after trading for repairs? A few £100? Surely not enough to augment their weapon systems.
Drake must have caught her questioning look. I've made Rodriguez a few promises.
What kind of promises? She asked.
The friends who came to our aid aren't the only ones betting on your captain, Rodriguez said. He was already famous from the war, and now you've thrashed Vargas. Now you have the best pirate ship in known space. Once Blackbeard is in action?
Drake looked pained. I don't know that we are really going to call it that. Rodriguez frowned.
That is not what I have heard.
It's more of a joke than anything, Tolvern said. I think we are still Ajax for now, right, Captain?
Should I tell them to paint over the Jolly Roger, then?
The yard owner asked. He nodded up at the ship, where two Hroom welders were at work fastening down the panel. The skull over crossed swords, or bones, had been the symbol of piracy for 1,000 years, since the days of wooden sailing ships on old Earth.
Leave the Jolly Roger, Drake said.
If people want to call the ship Blackbeard, let them. What people call us isn't the important thing.
Maybe not, but it pained Tolvern to see the Jolly Roger in place of the golden lions rampant of Albion that had once glimmered along Ajax's flank. After the shield repairs, there was nothing left of them.
"What's this about promises?" she asked again.
"We still owe Master Rodriguez £5,000," Drake said.
"That seems cheap for all this. Installing a serpentine alone would eat up 10, I'd think."
"And we owe him a 30% share in whatever loot we take from our expedition." Drake winced at loot, as if it pained him to even speak the word.
Tolvern still didn't know exactly what they were going to do on this expedition, and she doubted that Drake had told Rodriguez either. But the captain must have given the owner of the spaceyard enticing hints if he'd handed over thousands of pounds of weapons and labor on a promised cut of future earnings.
On second thought, she said, maybe it does matter what we're called. HMS Ajax doesn't sound quite right anymore, does it?
I told you, Drake said in a quiet voice. You can walk at any time.
And I already told you.
She turned back to Rodriguez.
When's all this going to be ready?
5 days. I might be able to cut it to 4 if I push my crew. No better than that.
No rush, Drake said. We'll need time to buy provisions, and I need to go through Carvalho's men one more time. Those who stay will need basic orientation before we drag them into space. I need to do it right. And maybe more pterillium will turn up in the meantime. In fact, I'll take a full week if it makes no difference to you.
You don't have a week, Rodriguez told them.
He explained, not 4 hours earlier, some sugar smugglers had reported via subspace communications from the planet of Peruano that they'd run into a powerful task force led by 2 royal cruisers with corvettes, destroyers, and torpedo boats.
Old friend of yours is leading the expedition, Rodriguez added. HMS Vigilant. They chased off a bunch of Froom and Ladino traders, scoped out Peruano, and are now closing toward a jump point that will take them here.
Peruano is in the neutral zone, Tolvern told the captain. According to the treaty, the Royal Navy, can't bring warships into the system. Rutherford is going to start another war.
I don't know anything about politics, Rodriguez said, but if they're coming here, I can only suppose they're looking for you. I suggest you be in space before they arrive.
He waved his hand at the ship.
I've got an investment to protect, not to mention my yards. I'd rather not see them overrun with Royal Marines.
Chapter 21 Rodriguez was as good as his word, and 4 days later, Drake had them lifting from the tarmac with a blast of plasma engines and a straining of the antigrav. When they reached space a few minutes later, Drake half expected to find Rutherford at the head of his task force, lurking, waiting for Drake to show himself. No sign of the man. As they accelerated toward the jump point, they overtook several merchant ships, but saw no naval vessels or warships of any kind. 6 hours from the jump point, Drake set Jane to autopilot the ship and called several of his crew into the war room. When they'd all arrived, he cast a glance across the table and tried not to let out a long, audible sigh. It was hard not to compare this gathering unfavorably to the similar meeting 6 months ago, before the Battle of Kif Lagoon. Rutherford had been on board during that earlier meeting, so the 2 captains could plan their joint assault. In addition, they'd brought their respective first officers and gunners, and the marine officers who would lead the ground assault on the Froom Fortress. A formidable collection of talent and plenty of class and breeding. Nib, Pym, and Barker had been at that earlier meeting, but he had little confidence in the rest of the crew in front of him now. No doubt Tolvern would make a great officer someday, but she was still green. Then there was Cap, volatile and dangerous. Smythe was a bright fellow, but the tech officer was so introverted that his mind was as hard to puzzle out as the ship's AI, except that Jane was a better conversationalist. That left Carvalho, who would take the place of the 2 marine captains in planning any ground action. Not exactly an equal trade, 2 gentlemen officers, for a would-be pirate. Maybe not, he reminded himself, but if not for the Ladino's timely intervention a few days ago, he'd be dead, his ship in the hands of Captain Vargas. Drake sat in silence, until the side conversations died down and the others looked at him expectantly. He cleared his throat.
You are not all privy to the same information, so I want to tell you what I know, or think I know.
Drake started by recapping what Nib Pym had said about the sugar antidote, a way to permanently block sugar from affecting the Froom brain. There was no saying it worked, or frankly, if it even existed, but the Admiralty apparently thought the antidote real enough
to resort to bloody measures to keep it secret. The antidote had been on board Henry Upton when Ajax attacked. Presumably, that's why Rutherford had broken off combat to go after the slave ship, to keep it from being lost.
"Why not destroy it?" Barker asked. "Why send it to Hot Barca?"
"I don't have a good answer to the first question. I believe Malthorn wishes to study it, perhaps to know if such a thing is truly possible, because if so, it might be invented a second time. Or maybe he wishes to search for an antidote to the antidote. As for why Hot Barca, that is easy enough to answer. Smythe, bring up a map of the planet, show us the equatorial continent." The tech officer tapped at his hand computer, and a globe appeared above the table, the red, cloud-covered world of Hot Barca. Drake brushed his fingers over the projection to strip away the cloud cover. The equatorial continent sat in front of him, roughly shaped like a fat slug that stretched halfway around the planet, with only the head and horns of the slug rising to more temperate latitudes. He zoomed in on the fat middle. "Lord Malthorn's estates. They are nearly 700,000 square miles, almost 10% of the entire continent, sweltering tropics with rich volcanic soil. Two-thirds of it has been given to sugarcane, mills, and a port for shipping the sugar. The rest of the forest is being cleared. See here?" Drake zoomed again. 18,000 square miles of bare ground, hacked and burned shortly before this projection was made, the next phase of his growing plantation.
"And you think the Lord Admiral shipped the antidote there?"
Tolvern asked.
"Malthorn is already the biggest slaveholder on Hot Barca," Drake said. "During the war, 1,600,000 new slaves were shipped to the Barca system. The vast majority are Hrum, of course, but not all of them. 8 out of every 10 new slaves came to the Malthorn estates. But he needs more. He always needs more. There is no end to the demand for sugar and the slaves to grow and process it."
"Slaves to make sugar,"
Nib Pim said. His high voice was tight, barely less strained than when he'd been fighting his own rescue from the slaver.
"And sugar to make slaves."
"Henry Upton was almost certainly traveling to Malthorn's estate," Drake said. "He has the most need for new slaves and faces the biggest risk should the sugar market collapse."
700,000 square miles, Carvalho said.
"How big is that? Give it to me in something I can understand."
"What's your home planet?" Tolvern asked him.
For a moment, the Ladino looked reluctant to answer, as if suspicious of why she would ask.
"Nuevo Tejas." "That's easy," Tolvern said. "Nuevo Tejas is practically a water world, just a bunch of islands. 700,000 square miles is two-thirds the size of all the landmass on your whole planet."
"King's balls," Cap swore.
"And it's all jungle and swamp and sugar plantations and stuff? How the devil will we find where they've hid the antidote?"
"The temperature in the lowlands of Malthorn's estate can exceed 95 degrees for weeks at a time," Drake said. "Between the heat and the humidity, a human simply cannot sweat enough to keep cool, not without air conditioning or some other special arrangement." Nib Pim let out a little whistle through his nose.
"Even for a Hrum, that is a miserable heat."
Drake zoomed again.
"These are the highlands. Malthorn keeps an estate up here, at 9,000 feet. He rarely visits. It's mostly business staff. But he has a large research center. It's largely agricultural science, adapting sugarcane and other human and Hrum crops to the soil and climate of Hot Barca. The heart of the facility is only a few thousand acres. I don't expect more than a few token guards."
"That's all well and good," Barker grumbled, "but it's not token guards I'm worried about."
The engineer reached out a hand and brought the focus of the map back out, first to the continental view, then to the entire planet. He set it into slow rotation.
"It's these bad boys right here."
Barker pointed to the 6 fortresses in orbit around the planet. A few decades ago, the Barca system had been on the front lines between the expanding Albion Kingdom and the crumbling remains of the Hrum Empire. The closest systems had been neutral, either Splinter Hrum or New Dutch and Ladino, and Albion had suffered from extended supply lines. The Crown
had built fortresses into the sides of two small moons, then hauled in four asteroids, converted them into forts, and set them in orbit as well. The concept had worked. When the fortresses repelled an invasion force in the Third Froom War, the Crown had been so taken with their success that Queen Ellen had financed the construction of a similar network around Albion herself.
"They're not what they used to be," Tolvern said. "Barca is no longer on the frontier."
"Doesn't mean they're in ruins either," Barker said. "We put in at one of them for repairs a few years back, before your time."
Tolvern scowled at this, apparently irritated by the reminder of her youth.
"I still think we can take them."
"Don't be cocky," Barker said. "The fort I saw may not have been on war footing, but it wasn't a derelict either. Plenty of wealth flows in and out of that world. Gotta be able to throw off pirates and smugglers."
The chief engineer nodded.
"Every one of those forts is still capable of delivering a punch."
"So are we, right?" Tolvern said. "Isn't that the point of all that time on San Pablo? If not, if you're still incapable of battle, by all means, tell us so we can correct the deficiencies while we still have time."
"You know that's not what I'm saying," Barker said. "I'll take on Vigilant if we have to, but slugging it out with an orbital fortress is another matter. We don't have enough firepower to silence her guns, and we don't have enough men to storm her fortifications either."
"Enough arguing," Drake said, growing impatient. "We're not going to knock down an orbital fortress, and we don't actually have to do that. Those things were built to repel Hroom sloops of war. The sloops couldn't land directly on the planet. They had to send down smaller craft. We don't have that limitation."
"You mean to run the forts?"
Cap said. She'd been watching the argument between Tolvern and Barker with a smug expression, but now she turned serious.
"That's right. We'll find the softest position and hit it there. Any given fort can hammer us as we're coming in, but the orbital guns are almost all outwardly facing. Once we're in the atmosphere, we have only ground forces to worry about."
"A few guards, some armed Hroom," Carvalho said. "Shouldn't be too much trouble."
"As if we have any clue," Barker grumbled. "We're even more ignorant about ground forces. For all we know, there's an entire regiment of Royal Marines guarding Malthorn's estate."
"Actually, no,"
Smythe said. He looked up from his computer where he'd been scrolling through data, or maybe just playing Romans versus Soviets again.
"I was on Malthorn's estate once."
"What?" Drake said, scowling. "When did that happen?"
"I was on Dreadnought for her inaugural tour. We took a pass through the colonies to test her engines and weapon systems before she went into battle."
"And you didn't think that was germane to the discussion?" Drake asked.
"That you knew Malthorn's estate personally?" Smythe wrinkled his brow, then shook his head, as if it only now were occurring to him that the captain might want to know.
"But how did you end up on the surface?" Tolvern asked. "Dreadnought is like a sloop of war. It can't enter the atmosphere either."
"The Admiral sent shipments down, security equipment for his estate. There had been a slave revolt or something. I can't exactly remember."
"You're a font of forgotten knowledge, aren't you?" Tolvern said.
"Go on," Drake urged.
Only a few weeks ago, Drake would have been shocked to hear that Malthorn had been using the mightiest battleship in the Navy as his personal delivery service. But almost nothing the Admiral did would surprise him any more.
"I saw the security set up for myself," Smythe continued. "There are minefields, some automatic guns, and a small garrison. Can't even imagine where the Admiral would station an entire regiment. The property isn't like that."
"What do you mean?" Drake asked.
"It may be the Highlands, but it's still bloody hot. Wet, swampy, with these mosquito things the size of a bird. I can still hear them buzzing behind me."
Smythe shuddered.
"The estate is built on the ruins of an old Hroom fortress, and half of it has sunk into the ground. Malthorn built atop a giant raised stone platform in the middle of the fortress."
"It's a temple, not a fortress," Nib Pym said. "If it has a platform, it's for Liam Carr, the god of death."
"We don't need to hear about your pagan death cults," Barker said. "What about the weapon systems?"
"It's not like that,"
the Hroom said.
"The two of you can argue religion later," Drake said. "As a matter of fact, let's leave off the specifics of Malthorn's estate. Smythe, write up a report, send it around. Give us anything you can remember, anything at all."
Send this bloke along with the team, Cap said. That's my vote. Nothing like having a guy who's been there before.
Me?
Smythe squeaked. I'll take that into consideration, Drake said. Whatever gives us the best chances.
Can we be clear about that part? Tolvern asked. Chances for what? What exactly are we going for here? The antidote and enough loot to pay our debts at the yard?
Carvalho and Cap looked a little more alert at the mention of loot. More or less, Drake said.
And when you get the antidote, will you share it freely? Nib Pim asked.
I don't know, Drake admitted. This whole thing is rotten. Rutherford is in neutral territory, as if he's trying to provoke another war. Malfourne is deep into slaving. He has enriched himself on the back of naval victories, sugar, slaves, and war. Seems like there's no way to separate them. It's corrosive, not only for the Hrum, but for Albion as well.
Then what? Tolvern asked. You're going to flip a switch and free a billion sugar eaters just like that? I don't know about you, but that scares the hell out of me.
You are not the only one, Drake admitted. He glanced at Nib Pim, who watched him with a clear, unblinking expression through his ink-colored eyes.
You sure it's only a billion? Barker asked. What about the Empire? What do they do when they're off the stuff?
I got no problem with Rome, Cap said, with a look at the pilot. Neither do any of us, when taken one at a time, Tolvern said. That isn't the issue. We're not talking about Nib Pim. Well, maybe we should, Cap insisted. This one is treated me good. And I knew a couple of Hrum in the Griffin Shoals. They weren't no trouble either, so long as you kept them out of the sugar.
So, what is your plan?
Nib Pim asked Drake. I want to get hold of this antidote, see if it's real, Drake said. Seize whatever documentation we can find about how it works, how to produce more and so on. After that, I don't know. I hope we can get enough info from the labs to show Malthorn's treason. I can present it to the king. Perhaps find other allies in the navy. Get him removed. Maybe then we could make a new treaty with the Hrum in return for the antidote. Drake was grasping now. Create buffer worlds. Control the supply of the antidote. I don't know. Something to ensure peace.
Peace is hard enough to enforce when we are strong and they're weak, Tolvern said. Without sugar, what can we do to stop them? There are too many. Give it 10-20 years. Eventually they'll be at our throats.
Drake had no rebuttal to this, because his commander was absolutely correct. He rose. Tolvern sprang to her feet in response, followed by the others, one by one. Carvalho was the last to rise, and he crossed his arms, his expression pointlessly sullen, as if he still needed to show his independence. Everyone here had a chance to stay behind on San Pablo, Drake said. None of you did. Whatever loyalties you had before have been swept away. There is no more Royal Navy. Only this ship and her captain. You all agreed to this, to submit to my authority. In return, I pledge to rule with justice, to safeguard those under my protection, to act with thought and caution, and not from whim or a desire for personal glory. No officer's life is worth more than the life of those beneath him, and the captain's life is of no greater value than that of his crew. Some of this he had cribbed from the oath that kings, dukes, barons, and other lords took when they were invested in their hereditary positions. He couldn't speak for the Hrum, but humans needed hierarchy, demanded it, in fact. In the absence of leadership, one man or woman would naturally assume it, often at the cost of strife and bloodshed. And it was the natural tendency of the ruler to despise and bully his subjects. Hence, the obligations from master to servant were, if anything, more important than the obligations flowing in the other direction. He needed them to know that although he ruled the ship, he would never abuse that position, never become a tyrant.
"Yes, sir," Tolvern said.
The others added their affirmations. And part of my duty is not to withhold information arbitrarily, Drake added. But the truth is, I do not yet know. We'll go to Hot Barsa and seize the antidote. But, and here he cast a look at his Hrum pilot, I don't know how we'll put it to use. I only promise to speak with all of you before making any decision. He waited for argument. There was none. He wished he could read Nib Pim's expression as clearly as he could read Tolvern's or Cap's, but he couldn't. Meanwhile, Drake reminded himself that his pilot had enslaved himself, turned into an eater, just to get his hands on the antidote. Nib Pim may be well behaved now, but there seemed no limit to what he would risk. "Now," Drake said, "I'm off shift, and desperately need rest before the jump. Next time I see you, we'll be on the other side." Chapter 22. Vigilant was the first ship of the Royal Navy Task Force through the jump. Rutherford fought off the stunned, nauseated feeling as he came out the other side, then brought Vigilant out about 10,000 miles, and waited as the other ships came through one at a time. Each ship would appear suddenly, motionless and helpless for several long seconds while the crews recovered. The plasma engines would restart, and the ship would limp away from the jump point like a drunk staggering out of a tavern. The last ship through was Calypso, another cruiser. Her captain was Hugh Lindzel, third son of the Earl of New Tasmania. Lindzel's father was Lord Admiral Malthorne's first cousin, and Malthorne had secured him command of Calypso less than a year out of the academy, young and headstrong. Yet Captain Lindzel had fought bravely, some said recklessly, at Epis III. Lindzel came on the viewscreen a few minutes later. The man blinked through bleary, bloodshot eyes.
"Are we clean, sir?"
"The enemy sloop didn't follow us through, if that's what you mean," Rutherford said. "We are still scanning the moons of the nearby gas giant for Empire forces. Doubtful they are violating the neutral system." "Which raises the question, why are we?" Rutherford let that hang between them for a beat, baiting Lindzel to answer. Perhaps the man knew more than he did. Perhaps not. An Empire sloop of war had followed them about the Peruano system. As per the treaty, it was alone, and its shields were down. At any time, Vigilant could have blown it to pieces with a single broadside, or turned loose a few torpedo boats to chase it off. Instead, Rutherford ignored it for several days, until finally the Froom commander had hailed him, asking why Albion had sent an armed task force to the frontier in defiance of the treaty. Rutherford responded that he was looking for a rogue cruiser. As soon as he found Ajax and brought Drake and his crew to justice, he would retreat from the neutral systems. Except that the treaty didn't provide any such loophole, the opposing commander helpfully pointed out. Rutherford closed the channel and ignored any further attempts at communication. "I will presume that the sloop sent a subspace to its headquarters," Rutherford said, when it became clear that his counterpart on Calypso had no answer. "San Pablo is even closer to the Hroom systems than Peruano. Should we expect to encounter Empire forces?"
"I wouldn't presume to speculate. You are the flag officer of this expedition."
"I'm asking your opinion. Give it to me."
"They'll have an observer, armed, I would think."
Lindzel hesitated, and Rutherford suspected he was holding something back.
"But will they risk war over San Pablo? I would think not."
"No, that would be foolish. The system was as good as lost to the Froom already, with a growing Ladino colony on one continent and an impoverished, collapsing Froom province on the other. But the next system over held a thriving Froom world. That must be protected at all cost."
"We'll proceed cautiously," Rutherford said. "As soon as the scans are finished, we'll approach San Pablo in double crescent formation. You will lead the van. Shields up, weapon systems down."
"Yes, sir."
Rutherford shut down the viewscreen to find Pittsfield standing behind his shoulder, nervously rubbing his hands.
"Sir, a secure communication packet came in from the fleet."
"What does it say?"
"For your eyes only. You are to take it alone in the war room."
Frowning, Rutherford picked his way across the bridge. The others watched him as he went. A knot of worry settled into his gut. They were strangers to him, except for Pittsfield. Admiral Malthorne had sent Rutherford to bring in the mutinied Ajax, but apparently fearing that Rutherford would also go rogue, had changed out familiar faces for strangers.
The irony was that if Rutherford did encounter Drake in combat, his green crew would put him at a disadvantage. Drake is one man. He has one ship. You have 14. Back in the war room, he shut the door and pulled up the secure subspace channel. The message was text only. Ajax has left San Pablo and jumped from the system. Destination unknown. Proceed to San Pablo and set up a blockade around the planet. Allow human shipping through, but turn away or seize any Froom vessels. The Froom gave aid and comfort to the traitor, and you will make an example of them. Destroy the 2 Froom space yards and the spaceport. Do so from orbit. Do not land on the planet or send any forces to the surface. Should any Empire military forces attempt to break the blockade, you will engage them with all available firepower. Aid shall be sent to you at once. Press accept when you have read this message. Rutherford leaned back in his chair, stunned. The message was unsigned, but it had come from the Admiralty, which meant that only a handful of people could have sent it, unless the system had been hacked. He had to allow for that possibility. But if authentic, good God. Only a few weeks had passed since the last battle of the previous war. The ink was barely dry on the treaty. But this? This would mean another war. Even if it were true that Ajax had been repaired in Room Yards, would Albion go to war over the slight? After a few seconds, the last part of the message began to flash yellow, then red. He pressed his thumb against the screen where it said accept. The message deleted itself. He sent a reply. Please confirm your orders as per the Naval Task Force's posture re-San Pablo. When it was off, he thought for a moment, then deleted the record of his own message. Better to be cautious in case they had been hacked. This far out, it might take a couple of days to receive a response. Until then, what choice did he have? He would proceed to San Pablo as if he intended to blockade the planet. That would kill some time, and he could set up cautiously in orbit instead of arriving at once and dropping atomic weapons onto the surface to wipe out the Froom yards and port. Why would the aliens do it? Their actions with regard to Ajax made no sense. Word of Drake's journey had been passing through to Rutherford, and he presumed information had been flowing outward to other interested parties as well. For that matter, why would Drake ask for whom help? The rogue captain had attacked and defeated the pirate ship that had given Richmond so much trouble. Then he'd jumped to San Pablo, where he'd landed at some undisclosed location. Why not the human settlements? They had yards, men willing to work for coin, even if that meant aiding the enemies of Albion. No need to consult the Froom at all. A darker thought entered Rutherford's mind. The Lord Admiral, or maybe even the Crown itself, was using Drake's mutiny as a pretext for agitating the Froom Empire. Malthorn wanted another war. The Empire was a huge realm, with dozens of systems and billions of people. A big, indigestible chunk. But cut off pieces like a man slicing salami, and it could be consumed piecemeal. Of course, it meant a never-ending series of wars, but in the past, there had always been a good reason. Unprovoked attacks on Albion shipping, disruption of the sugar trade, or a denial of Albion trade privileges. Not this time. This war would be Albion's fault, and Albion's alone. Maybe this time is no different. Maybe all those other wars were provoked by Albion as well. He quickly put that thought out of his head. And anyway, it wasn't his duty to question the decisions of the Admiralty. No doubt there was some big unknown piece of information to which he was not yet privy. For now, he would seek verification, but act as if the orders were genuine. Rutherford came out of the war room feeling more confident. The scan for enemy craft had turned up no activity, and the plasma engines were pushing them forward again. He took his seat and ordered Pitsfield to send a message to the rest of his fleet. Missile frigates and torpedo boats were to be on alert. the cruisers would keep shields raised, but the two destroyers would drop shields and present cannon.
"No cloaking?"
Pitsfield asked before sending the message.
"No, we will come in with an aggressive posture."
Pitsfield raised his eyebrows at this.
"Has something changed, sir? Anything the rest of us should know about?"
"The message was for my eyes only, Commander. You seem to have forgotten this."
Rutherford delivered this with a sharp look, and his first mate moved hastily to comply without further argument. Soon, the entire task force was hurtling toward the inner system, posture aggressive, ready for war. Chapter 23. The cruiser, until recently known as Ajax, came stealthily into the Barca system. Shields down so they could be fully cloaked, Drake took the additional precaution of lurking for hours next to a gas giant while he sent out sentinels to scan for activity. For 24 hours, they waited in the howling maelstrom of the gas giant's outer atmosphere while the sentinels collected information. When he brought them back in, they revealed that 11 Royal Navy vessels had come into the Barca system in the weeks since the attack on Henry Upton and the battle with Vigilant. Of these, 4 were on their way to a jump point. The other 7 were patrolling the shipping lanes. Only a single destroyer was in orbit around Hot Barca itself. Drake thought he could handle a single destroyer without much fuss. It was the orbital fortresses that worried him. Still, the position of the patrolling ships would force him to approach Hot Barca at an odd angle, which meant swinging halfway around the sun and then coming at the planet from above. The weakest of Hot Barca's forts orbited the shallow, swampy ocean on the North Pole, and that was how Drake intended to approach. The captain was in his quarters, beneath the hot spray of a shower, turning over tactics for the pending battle, when the sound of someone pounding on his door caught his attention. He came out with a towel wrapped around himself to hear Tolvern in the corridor outside his quarters, shouting for him to open up.
"Is it an emergency?"
he called through the closed doors.
"I have news!"
"Can't it wait?"
"You want to hear this, hurry!"
He sighed, wishing he'd ignored the pounding. Tolvern seemed to have a talent for interrupting men in the shower, as Rutherford could have attested, being taken in the mutiny in just such a condition. When Drake let her in a few minutes later, she paced back and forth across the room as she told him what had happened. Smythe had intercepted a poorly encrypted military communication. The Navy was in an uproar. It seemed that a large naval task force, nearly an entire fleet, had set up in orbit around San Pablo and blockaded the planet. The Froom objected, tried to drive off the force,